Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Reyes Bertolin. I'm a professor of classics at the University of Calgary. I'm your host today for the New Books Network. And with me today is my friend and colleague, Dr. Peter Tui. He's as well a professor of classics. He has many varied interests, research interests, and among them, Greek and Roman epic poetry, history of emotions, cultural history of medicine, and the history of madness. He has authored 6 books, and most recently, he has published a book called Boredom, A Lively History, which appeared in 2011, a book called Jealousy in 2014, and the book that has brought us together today is his latest one, Hold On, The Life, Science, and Art of Waiting, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. Well, Peter, thank you very much for agreeing to this interview.
It's a pleasure, Reyes.
Good. And I just have a series of questions, so let's get started. I mean, you are a classical scholar, and your latest work has been on the modern and contemporary on the modern and contemporary aspects of emotions. Was it easy to transition from the classical world to the modern world?
It goes back in time that I guess the transition was so early in my career that I didn't notice it. My interest in the modern things was working on ancient notions of boredom. That goes right back to the 1980s, so it goes back a long way. When I wrote that, no great article now looking back makes me shudder a little bit. But at any rate, you know, that's what I wrote then, and you live with what you've written. But looking at boredom then, it struck me, or at least the conclusions I reached, led me to an interest in the modern condition of boredom. And if you wanted to explain that, it's pretty easy to say that there's not much written about boredom in the ancient world, very little. And what you get is quite late, particularly late, say, with your interests. You don't see boredom easily identified in authors like Homer or Hesiod and so on. So you tend to see it much later. You can get it in Plutarch or authors like that. So it led me to think, writing about the small amount of sources, is why is there so little depiction of boredom in the ancient world and so much in the modern world? So you can see there's the, if you like, the transitions are built in. As soon as you start to think about the ancient world, you start to think about the modern world. And you could say, well, the ancients must have been bored. Well, sure. But they don't talk about it. That's the difficult thing for us. Whereas we never shut up about it. I mean, you know, there's a book comes out about it about every 6 months, and there's a lot of hullabaloo about it. You know, the latest book on boredom. You think, boy, you know, I mean, How many more do we need? I don't know, lots. But anyhow, that gives you a sense of the transition that was never really a transition, just a gradual easing in.
Okay. So you have written about emotions previously, you know, like we were just talking about boredom and jealousy. How did you move from that to the study of waiting? Is waiting an emotion? Can it be considered an emotion?
But you could look at the first part of it first. How do you move from waiting to from boredom to waiting? And it's, you know, people with small children in their houses, say grandchildren, know all about Peppa Pig. And Peppa Pig goes to the dentist. You know, she's a little cartoon character for kids about 4 years and 3 years old. They stop looking at it aged about five. Peppa's waiting at the dentist and she lets forth a howl. Says, "Boredom, waiting is boring," she says. So in a sense, there's the link, if you like. Well, it's not at all. You know, they're completely different situations, but it feels often like waiting is immensely boring. You're parked in a traffic jam and you let out a curse, "This is boring." You're waiting in the checkout in the supermarket and you're waiting too long and you say, "This is boring," at the beginning of the pandemic, the first lockdowns. You're waiting outside the Sunnyside health food store, as I did on many occasions, and you're thinking, "This queue is boring," and so on. So there you can see there's a natural affinity. It's probably not a fair affinity, I believe, between boredom and waiting. So in a sense, that's how it leads to us. The link to jealousy is there, but that's a little more complicated and tedious. But we may get back to that. That answers your first question. But you also asked me, can boredom be considered an emotion? And maybe it's jumping too quickly to say it, but here's the sort of the story you'd make with it, that most situations involving waiting seem to have a fairly standard brain chemistry, and they seem to exploit either dopamine, which has its own excitements, or serotonin, which doesn't seem to produce pleasure in creatures, but it seems to be emerge within the brain in these situations where pairing is involved, not necessarily, you know, the full throes of erotic and emotional love at the beginning of a relationship, but say between parents and children, probably between brothers and sisters, between couples that have been linked up for a fair amount of time. That's the serotonin one, a little harder, but waiting can be exciting too. If you're waiting for something good to happen, dopamine is going to flow. And you might say you're stuck in the traffic and it should be boring, but you might be going to do something really interesting, see somebody you really like, or who knows what. But then it's exciting, isn't it? And roiling in the brain is this pleasure neurotransmitter or neurochemical dopamine. So what I'm getting at there is that there's a limited amount of brain chemistry, it appears, that's linked with boredom, and to have an emotion work in the brain, there's always got to be brain chemistry. So you seem to have that, and it's of a limited sort. Then there is what you could call a phenotype, that is to say, a series of gestures or situations people find themselves in that can evoke this sort of emotion, and there's certainly phenotypes linked with boredom, let's say, and there is with anger, isn't it? You know, if I were angry now, you could tell from looking at me. If you are bored with what I'm saying now, I could tell from looking at you. You're looking bored. Anyhow, there you have the phenotype plus the brain chemistry. And what's the phenotype for waiting? It's a person is stuck, they're paused, and so on. Or they may even, like these little vervet monkeys, be indulging in this sort of lengthy, several hours a day, mutual grooming, plucking, stroking, and so on. So that's a long story, but then it's a long sort of question to answer. If waiting's to have status as an emotion, rather than simply a situation, which is what Peppa Pig's grumbling about, then what leads you to think maybe it could be one of these new sorts of emotions, emotions we haven't recognized before, is the brain chemistry and the phenotype. That's what I believe, but, you know, it's not something you'd want to stake your life on. It's something to put out there and say, maybe we've been thinking about waiting wrongly. It has the emotional independence of something like empathy, for example, or even excitement.
So I was just thinking while you were talking, so is then are new emotions being created or being defined? Is there not a set of emotions? How does it work?
They're always there. I don't think emotions are ever invented. Emotions have a sort of, what's the word? They have a almost Darwinian function within human beings. Emotions are there to benefit us. The simplest one always to illustrate is anger. That of course anger's a bad thing, but in many instances anger's a very good thing, isn't it? You know, someone tries to attack your husband or your mother or your brother. Anger's liable to boil inside you, and you're liable to step in. So in that sense, anger's beneficial. And, you know, as you know, the Greeks felt this all the time. It's when these emotions get out of hand that it's a problem. What am I getting at? That emotions of the sorts that I've been writing about have always been with us. It's just we don't always identify them. And perhaps, and this may sound a little more trickier, we don't always need them. That an emotion such as boredom, for example, is less common in the ancient world, probably, not because it doesn't exist, but because it's such a public world they live in. It's a household where you're never alone. If it's in Rome, the slaves are sleeping on the floor. There's no slave quarters. You're never alone. So your chances or your options for, if you like, for experiencing boredom are not quite as manifest as they are in a world where we spend huge amounts of time. Well, maybe we don't, but we think we spend a lot of time alone. Now, anger's an easy one. Boredom's a little more complicated because it seems to shift in its frequency, seems to, rather than necessarily does. And I think you'd say the same in a way with waiting, that imagine you are almost any culture until recently. Why would you talk about waiting? It seems so obvious and so common a thing that you don't need to discuss it. So in a sense, that's what a new emotion is. It's an emotion that you become a little more conscious of its role within the human psychology. So it's always been there, but it's something that we perhaps didn't pay the sort of heed to it that we ought to have. That's my position. Part of it.
Okay. Are waiting and boredom in opposite or are the same? At the end of your book, you mentioned something like boredom is the enemy of waiting. Like I'm more like a Peppa Pig. I would associate boredom with waiting or waiting with boredom, but you seem to argue differently.
Yes, I think there you focus on just one aspect of boredom. And for example, you know, you wonder why I mention things from my life frequently, but it's what one does. But my father was a most unbored man. He was pretty good at waiting too. And it wasn't so much that he was patient. It's just that there the waiting is unrelated to boredom, and it's often to something good that's coming up. Now, I think that you neglect in your waiting experience, the great book of waiting in your life, if you like, all the times when waiting is in fact a very pleasant thing. It's very exciting. The dopamine's there. That you neglect the sort of waiting, the hanging around, if you like, you could use it that way, the holding on that you do with your family. with small children, it's often excruciatingly boredom, but you know you're going to do it. And you know there's going to be a payoff at the end of it. And the payoff with the children is affiliation. And there's my little tag. If you can't wait, you can't affiliate. And it really seems to be true. The strength of a bond between an adult and a child is linked with the amount of time, particularly the adult is willing to wait with the child, watch them play, intervene occasionally. I mean, you spend hours sitting on a couch or a chair with children while they play, while they periodically talk to you or ask you to interact. Now, it can be boring, but it's not really. It's sort of waiting, and you know what comes at the end of it instinctively. The bond grows with the child, and you're able to play a role, often a beneficial role, you hope, because of this waiting. So it's not as simple as the patience, which I should have emphasized that my father displayed. Patience is a small subset of waiting, and nor is it the same as boredom, which is just a small subset and can be of that experience. We can say more about boredom in its definition to explain it. But that, I think, I'd say is what you're underestimating, just how often enjoyable boredom is, waiting is, how scary it can be sometimes. And how often exciting it is. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, so I guess there are many types of waiting, no? That's what it comes to. And so, I mean, you've categorized several types of waiting in your book. How many do you think there are?
Well, the three main types, I think, that I talk about are pairing, which is what we've been talking about with children, this notion that if you can't wait, you can't affiliate. The second of the sorts is, if you like, the pause, which we haven't talked about at all, but a pause, and if I were to do one now, let's say it produces an effect, and its effect is to increase excitement. Public speakers use it constantly, don't they? There's been books written about it and theses, you know, PhD theses written on it, calculating how long does, you know, François Mitterrand pause? He was very good at them. And how long does someone like Barack Obama, who was a powerful speaker and he utilized the pause a lot, how long do his pauses go? But they're actually short. One of the examples that I use is Miles Davis, the American jazz musician, the trumpeter, would often hold a cigarette when he was playing. So you can imagine the cigarette in his hand with the trumpet. Or he'll simply stop playing, let somebody else play, and then he'll smoke. So he's using the cigarettes, and you can see this on Vivo on YouTube. He uses the cigarette as a way of pausing and increasing the excitement, because you're looking at him smoking, and you know at the end of that smoke he's going to start playing again. Well, that'll be good if you like that sort of music. So that the pause then, which we haven't said, can be used in lots and lots of different ways, but it's particularly linked to performance. I'm sure you used it a lot when you were lecturing, or when you lecture here at the University of Calgary.
Yeah, I guess.
You're silent at that one. You gave me a pause back, so what can I say?
Yes, I guess.
And so the other third one, I think I mentioned, was dread. That's an easy one. If you're going to be executed, you're waiting. And dread's bad then. The harder thing is to look at situations of dread and see, can they ever or are they ever turned to people's advantage? So there's the three sorts, and they really are. They're the main ways that boredom waiting operates. The things like patience are a tiny subset of waiting, and I think really boredom is a separate thing altogether, though it seems linked to it, and I think we're probably just muddying the waters to make the link.
Okay, thank you very much. So another aspect that comes up often in your work is the use of images. Like
I've lost your sound. Can't hear you.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, I heard you then.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah, no. So I was asking that another aspect that comes often in your work is the use of work of art, whether they are like paintings or photographs, sculptures. So, I have two questions about that. The first one is, how do you go about finding these works that represent the emotions or the, or in this case, the waiting that you want to portray? And the other question is that sometimes I find your explanation of the art rather subjective. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's like you want to see the emotion in that painting, but that maybe someone else that wasn't thinking about that would not necessarily interpret it that way.
Your second question first, am I being subjective in this? Probably a lot less than you'd imagine. The reason for that is that there's, it's like, I don't know, Homeric formulae or something like that, you know. I mean, you tell a student, you, not me, about the wine dark sea, and they say, well, that's not a cliche, it sounds really good. And you say, well, listen, when you've read as much Homer as me and you've met wine dark sea or you know, godlike Achilles 100 times, you know it's a, you're dealing with a trope. Would you agree on that one?
Yes.
And I think it's pretty much the same with a lot of painting, that there's tropes, and painters who've been taught know the tropes and they play with them, and we don't get them necessarily unless we've spent quite a lot of time looking at them or read the books that'll explain them to you. You know, the tropes linked to boredom, let's say, and to depression are well known, and there's been many fat books talk about them. And my own little contribution to that would be simply to try and distinguish boredom from depression. Now, I think that one's sort of cut and dried, the boredom depression one, because we're dealing with patterns in Western art, and not just Western art, that go back a long, long way. With waiting, it's less easy. You're looking for a picture, essentially, or you're hoping a picture will pop out to you that displays a person in a state of being paused, as it were. Jealousy is easy, because I pair these three books up, not call them a trilogy, but a trio, if you like. Jealousy always has threes in them. It's just unavoidable. Jealousy is... It's the emotion behind the emergence of the third actor in Greek tragedy. See, I seriously mean it. Once you've got three people there, you have a tension because somebody's going to be excluded or listening, and what they're listening to is going to affect them. So you can't be jealous of a person, another person, unless there's a third element, either a person or a thing, which can be money or position or whatever, involved. I think that's true, you know, that boredom is jealousy is a triadic emotion. It's always threes. So when you're looking at art and you see three people involved, once you know about this almost cliche of the experience, you say, well, no, I'm not being subjective. Why are there three people here? And sometimes it's simply accidental. But somebody like Munch, who paints jealousy again and again and again, uses triangular situations like this always when he's trying to depict jealousy. You can't paint a sort of broiling or roiling picture like Strindberg will try and do and say, this is jealousy, your mind's a mess. Well, you know, your mind might be a mess from indigestion. So we get to waiting. So we've had really the one with boredom. Boredom's a solitary emotion, as is depression, which is a mood, not an emotion, but it's both of them reflect a person who's cut off from the world of circumstances and linkage to other people. Waiting is always for something else, and usually for us, it's for another person. It really is. I mean, sure, if you're outside the Sunnyside health food store, it's to get inside to buy some food, but often you're waiting to meet somebody whom you like very much, sometimes somebody you don't. So that's where the pairing comes in, and that's where I'd say that it's not half as subjective as you'd think. Now, I may get it wrong with some of the art that I use, but that's a different matter. That the basic notion of pairing linked to waiting, linked to art, I think is a pretty strong one, particularly when you compare it with the threes, the triples in jealousy, and the sole person, which is what you get with boredom and depression. So there's an explanation. You don't have to buy it. That's all right. And some of my illustrations may be wrong. That's a different matter. How do I get these things? It's mysterious. They just come to me. I mean, they really do. I mean, I look at a lot of art every day. I spend time looking at quite a lot of it. And these things they just come. So what can I say?
Yeah.
How it happens.
I have the same experience looking at inscriptions, for instance. No, they just come to you. For sure they do.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. Once you're in the groove of these sorts of experiences or athletic lives and so on that you work on, these things do seem to just come out of the blue. You just read and you find these things. And it's not something that you will, is it? It's just something that appears because you're conscious of the sort of parameters within which these things can appear.
Yes, and as you were talking and you mentioned that depression was not an emotion, that it was a mood. What's the difference between a mood and an emotion?
Usually it's said to be time, okay. Just time. That is to say, you know, a feeling is something that's quick. And it's something you're often not conscious of. An emotion is something that persists, but it usually, you don't stay angry for weeks. You stay angry, you can stay angry for an hour, but it's not something that lasts forever. And similarly with boredom, these are emotions and I'd say waiting too, are of limited temporal duration. But a mood is something that lasts and lasts, does it not? So, you know, a major depressive disorder can last up to a year, and there's another one, persistent depressive disorder, that can last for 3-4 years. I mean, that's really the distinction between a mood and an emotion. It's duration, I think.
Okay. Well, I guess this brings us to another topic, and it's that of mental disease, that you work on mental disease, not the history of madness. And I'm curious about what motivates to write you about that and why is that aspect so prevalent in your work?
It's mental disorder is at the back of everything I write. There's no doubt about that. You're right to point it out. Even in the book going back, say, four books, Melancholy, Love and Time, which is about depression and the way that time can play into it and so on. But I think, really, in misused emotions, and sometimes we can't help it, cause huge chaos within people's lives. You know, an emotion like jealousy, it can be sometimes good. You know, it makes you competitive. It makes you get on at work. That's mostly how it plays out for us. And what's wrong with that? That's just capitalism in action. You know, I mean, you can be down on capitalism, sure, but it works off competition. And your athletes, I mean, they're jealous in a sense. They want the big prize, don't they? We don't think of them that way, but this is a sort of competitive emotion.
Sorry, Peter, I lost you. Can you repeat what you were saying?
With the athletes?
Yeah, like we don't think about them.
Or further back.
Just with the athletes. I lost you for a
while. Well, we tend not to think about athletes as subject to, to jealousy. But if we think of jealousy rather as a competitive emotion, rather than just thinking about it as it's got to do with sex, which, it, you know, it's way more complicated than that, but as a competitive emotion, then it's not a bad thing. You would never say, you know, you were wrong to go to the Olympics and to, you know, to try and defeat someone in the marathon. You'd say, well, that's what we're, you know, we've subscribed to this Olympics broadcast to see you do. Whether they're Greeks or moderns, it's a competitive situation, and that involves three things, is it not? Two athletes or more, but, it, you know, in a sense, two athletes and a prize, and the prize is the third thing. And they're competing to get the prize, and so it is. So it is in human life, you would say. What got us started on jealousy? Now I've gone so far on.
Well, we were talking about mental diseases and how that is a constant in your
yes,
world.
Yeah. So as you can see, I mean, jealousy is a good thing mostly, and we don't call it jealousy. Then we don't even call it envy. We simply call it a competitive emotional state or something like that. We say competition's good. But we'll also say, don't let it get the better of you. Don't let it get you to go a little bit crazy and hate the person you're competing with and try and harm them so that you'll win, you know, to trip them up or push them over a bridge. But this happens, does it not? That the competitive spirit turns into a driving jealousy, which is not unlike sexual jealousy, or the jealousy we get at work, the way people will jockey for position, to for promotion, to be, you know, more important and or earn more, or whatever it is. Emotions get out of hand, is what I'm saying, and they get out of hand all the time. And it seems to me profoundly sad and worrisome. That's part of it. But the other two is, you know, the big emotional problems. Problems relating to psychosis and to bipolar disorder and to depression. Frankly, I find them probably the most saddening but important things in our life. We can't get away from them, not necessarily with ourselves, but the people around us. The portions of Calgary where I live are full of people who suffer psychotic disorders, and it's very, very distressing. And for me, I think, you know, mental unhealth is the core of the most worrisome aspect of human life. And that's why so often I write about it, and why I try and show with things like boredom, with jealousy, with depression, with waiting, how sometimes they can be turned to our advantage and sometimes not harm us, which is what I hope to try and display, in at least in these last three books.
Yeah, and do you think in the ancient world this idea of mental disease was as prevalent as is it in the modern world?
The simplest way, I think, or the most assertive way of saying it is, this is what the local neurologists here tell me, that they say major depressive disorder, as far as they can tell, in any culture, sits at about 4.4%, 4.5% of the population will suffer major depressive disorder. Once you've had one burst of trouble with it, it's going to come back. So you may have four or five outbreaks, if you like, of the condition in your life. Doesn't have to stay as a permanent thing, you know. But having said that, if it's this constant, they will assert that historically it's simply part of the human makeup. Now, to what extent is it prevalent in the ancient world? Well, there seems to be evidence enough in late literature with Galen and so on in the ancient world that it's there for sure. They understand it. When they talk about melancholia, they mean depression in our sense, and often quite severe depression. So it was there, but to what extent were they able to mitigate it? To what extent was it eased by life expectancy? You know, I mean, if at birth most men are dead at 26, then their worst phase of depression, beginning, say, around 19, isn't very long, is it? And just the rough justice in the street. I mean, there's no police force, is there? The cities aren't lit at night. A person who's a danger to themselves and to others may indeed suffer rough justice in the streets. There's other things you can say about that, because there's, you know, there's plenty of testimony to people who are troublesome in the digest and in the legal codes. But it must have been there, but some things mitigated. There's no doubt about that. And the family is certainly one of them. And life expectancy, I'm sure, plays into it. There's evidence of psychotic conditions. Clear examples of it. You know, it feels like people have said when Ajax kills himself in the play and in stories generally, that he's suffering severe depression. And I don't think that's the case. It's psychotic. He doesn't know who he's looking at. He doesn't recognize Athena. He doesn't realize that he's, who he's got, that he's got animals strapped up, thinking they're his enemies and so on. And we'd call that now psychosis, wouldn't we? And it surely is. So it's there in ancient life. It's just mitigated by some of the circumstances. Above all, you'd think, by the fact of people not living long enough. You know, I mean, as people often say, most Roman men, and it's probably even more true of Greeks, didn't know their fathers. No wonder they went to the gym so much. They had to speak to an adult somewhere. Let us go no further with that. But what do you do in a world where your father's liable to be dead? You're going to have to be acculturated somehow or another, but this spills over, because mental illness doesn't begin usually until 19 or 20. It can be a little older with things like bipolar disorder. So that limits the prevalence, doesn't it?
Okay, thank you very much. And I just have a few other questions, mostly a little bit to keep it a bit lighter, I guess. But you talk quite a bit about your personal experience, which has come up in the talk already. But again, you know, do you feel comfortable talking about your own experience to large audiences? I mean, you have large audiences for your books and for your podcast. And so how comfortable do you feel about it?
Well, I don't tell them anything I don't want them to hear. You know, I mean, that's for sure. I mean, you know, there's things that you simply won't say. And, you know, like Juvenal, I talk more about the dead than the living oftentimes. But it doesn't bother me in the least. I mean, we're talking about mental conditions here and often great mental pain. There's got to be skin in the game from the person who's writing the book, I think. I mean, people say, why did you write about boredom? And the answer is because it's something I've suffered and continue to suffer constantly throughout my life. Why would I not admit to that? You know, nearly everybody who writes about boredom comes clean on it and says, well, that's why I wrote about it. You know, it bothers me a lot. The idea of turning to a subject without personal involvement just seems to me bizarre. Really, I mean, you're very interested in athletics. In your ordinary life, that is to say, non-scholarly life, and it flows over into your scholarly life. You write about athletics because it's something that concerns you and gives you great pleasure. So, you know, we're not talking about pleasure here, but nobody's hearing anything that that is shocking or that they don't experience themselves. I mean, yeah. Is that a fair answer?
It is a fair answer, yes. I was just thinking that writing about boredom and getting pleasure from writing about boredom, how contradictory it is.
Well, I think the answer to that is people write books like this to try and cure themselves of it. They won't always admit to it, but I'm happy to admit to that. You know, does it work? I doubt it, but you know, you're Hope springs eternal.
Yes. Like sometimes I had heard that all people study psychology to psychoanalyze themselves, no? So I guess...
I'm sure there's an element of that in it, without a doubt. There's lots of other reasons now. I mean, that couldn't explain the huge numbers they get in first-year psychology. But but for sure, I think you can't write with feeling about a subject unless you are involved with it in your own life. I think the idea of being the sort of indifferent scholar is just seems to me unbelievable. No one would do that. I could imagine, maybe you write about the Greeks just for some bizarre reason. They fascinate you. But there's got to be more to it than that. You write about Greek and Roman politics. You must be pretty interested in the cut and thrust of it yourself, in following it and watching it and what happens in the world in which you live, I would think.
Yes. Yeah, and I just have one last question, and I thought it was really funny at the end of your book when I was just reading that your book on boredom was in an Irish prison and the prisoners had the choice to read it.
And they liked it, yeah. And the journalist, the Irish journalist with an Anglo-Irish name instead of the bog Irish name that I have, sneered at it. Well, you know, you can get very serious about this. You know, when you put people in jail, I think, there's rules about what you can do to them in jail. Would you not say that you give them 3 years and that doesn't mean that they get beaten up in jail? It doesn't mean that they get no food on Wednesdays. It doesn't mean that if they're young, they're sexually molested. That we owe a duty of care to people in jail, and their punishments should be strictly demarcated. Now, to bung a person in jail and to bore them out of their mind, which is a frequent complaint about jail, seems to me not part of the deal. You know, the judge should sit up there. I'm giving you 3 years for speeding through Calgary in the daylight, and you're going to be subjected to the normal situations of being in jail, and you're going to be bored too. And that's part of your punishment. All right, fair enough. But I don't think boredom should be just an add-on situation for prisoners' lives, nor should they be subjected to prolonged solitary confinement, which is an excruciating form of boredom, as well as many other things. That fair's fair. And I think that the reason these prisoners were reading the book is, and they were probably very disappointed with it, but their lives as prisoners were immensely boring, and this is seen again and again and again. So we shouldn't laugh about it. We shouldn't do it to them, just in the same way as there's a Spanish scholar that I know from Madrid who's very interested to work. She's an expert on boredom. Trust me, she's the president of the International Boredom Society. There is one. Yeah. And she wants to work with old people. She wants to shift from being a philosopher to almost a social worker, because she's so worried about the prevalence of boredom in old age homes. So she's got older people in her family, and it worries her. That shouldn't be part of your punishment of being put into a retirement home, should it? Wouldn't you say?
No, of course not.
You'll go in there for the rest of your life, and we'll feed you and we'll bore you stiff. You know, I mean, that's a sure way to kill them off.
Actually, now with the pandemic, they were saying that many old people die because they couldn't contact other people.
Yeah. I'm quite sure that, if you think about boredom being the enemy of waiting always is with something else that's going to happen. And usually, and oftentimes, it's something good. But boredom, there's no end to it. That's why it's, there is an end, but it's for a period of time which you can't control, like a hugely long Easter sermon in church. You know, I mean, they can be excruciatingly boring because you can't go anywhere. You're stuck. You know it's going to end, but it's not going to end for a good long while. But you imagine you're stuck there for all eternity, or at least the last 5 years of your life. You're not going to get visitors. You're not going to be stimulated. No wonder it's playing havoc with people's health. I mean, I would say it's a serious issue for people. So, and this is why boredom is the enemy of waiting, because waiting is with something concrete in mind, and usually it's something we can we're looking forward to, unless you're on death row, but that's another matter.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. That was very interesting and very clarifying, and I hope our listeners enjoyed as much as I did. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.